The United States is recognized as the most religiously diverse country in the world, and yet its laws and customs, which many have come to see as normal features of American life, actually keep the constitutional ideal of religious freedom for all from becoming a reality. Christian beliefs, norms, and practices infuse our society. They are embedded in our institutions, creating the structures and expectations that define the idea of Americanness. Religious minorities still struggle for recognition and for the opportunity to be treated as fully and equally legitimate members of American society. Kiathi Joshi is the author of the new book, White Christian Privilege, which traces Christianity's influence on the American experiment from before the founding of the Republic to the social movements of today, mapping the way through centuries of slavery, westward expansion, immigration, and citizenship laws. She also reveals the way Christian privilege in the United States has always been entangled with notions of white supremacy. We welcome Kiathi Joshi to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me, Joe. Delighted to be with you.
Well, a delight to have you. Again, the name of the book is White Christian Privilege. You are a professor of education at Fairleigh Dickinson University. So what brought you down this path?
Well, the book is really both a personal and professional project. A professional one because there's been a lot coming out about whiteness and the construction of whiteness in America over the last decade or so. But what's been missing and what my book, how my book fills that gap is looking at the influence of Christianity on the construction of whiteness. Seeing the way that Christianity and whiteness together are embedded in our laws, Supreme Court decisions, lower court decisions, and so on. It's a personal project because as a little brown Hindu girl growing up in Atlanta, Georgia, I encountered my fair share and then some of racial and religious discrimination. And sometimes, though, I wasn't being discriminated against. It's just that I didn't fit in. I didn't know the secret handshake, if you will. And so I just stuck out with sometimes really terrible consequences. And so have others, as the data I've collected over the years has shown. So writing this book, while it's about a 20-year project, if you will, I've been talking about Christian privilege in my research, teaching, and things for about 20 years, but really it's much longer than that because of the things I have experienced growing up and living in this country.
The subtitle of the book, as I mentioned, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America, and I did touch on this in the introduction as well. But let us talk for a moment about that idea of what the illusion is.
Well, the illusion, so I talk about religious freedom as an optical illusion, because an optical illusion, if you think about it, prevents you from seeing what's right in front of you. So because we have freedom of religion enshrined in the First Amendment, a lot of people think, well, it's there on paper, so therefore it must exist in reality, right? But that's really not the case. Not all religions are on the same footing. If they were, we would not have opposition to synagogues or Hindu temples or mosques when they're being constructed in different communities across this country. The other thing an optical illusion does is it distorts what you're looking at, so it appears to be something else. And so here, because, again, we have people believe and know that we have First Amendment, a religious freedom enshrined in the First Amendment, we will often see religious and racial minorities being talked about in just in terms of the racial discrimination they might face, but not the religious discrimination. I am an Indian American Hindu. Sometimes it's very difficult to separate why I'm being, you know, discriminated against. It, the two go hand in hand. And so we've got to be able to start seeing that, and that's why I talk about it as an illusion.
You make this point in the book that white, Christian, American have been used interchangeably for a long time and so often that in many contexts, they remain synonymous for one another. Talk a little bit about that and ultimately how we can get away from that.
Well, one thing that has happened recently is when the president walked to the church near the White House, St. John's Episcopal, and, you know, held up the Bible, waving it around, in terms of saying, hey, I'm fighting for this country, and here's how I'm fighting for this country. I'm using the Bible to fight for what's American. I mean, right there is your image of white and Christian and American going together. Trump holding up that Bible, and some might say, well, you're saying Christian, and, you know, we have black Christians, and we have Asian American Christians, and we have Hispanic Christians. Yes, we do. But his policies and that of his administration have made it pretty clear who he's standing with when he's referring to Christian America. What we have to do is we have to be able to see these structures that exist in history, in our laws, in order to move forward. I want your listeners knowing that this book, I really believe it's one of the most patriotic things I could do. It is about seeing what hasn't gone right so that we can make things go right. My goal is to build a more perfect union, and we can't get to justice without seeing the injustices, and that's what this book is about.
White, well, let's talk about Christianity. I'm interested, as you say, it makes frequent appearances in our media, and it appears even more often, you say, in the subtext. Let's talk about that subtext.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we see it?
Well, you can, if I go back to the example I just brought up of what the president did,
yes.
Look at the coverage of that. The coverage is all about how evangelicals will take it. The coverage is all about, oh, is his evangelical base fracturing? 40% of this country doesn't identify as Christian. And there's very little coverage about, well, what's the impact of this on that 40%? You know, so we can see it in the media coverage. We can see it, the subtext comes about in how we think about people running for office. And those who are religious minorities are held to a different standard. Those who are racial and religious minorities are held to a different standard. Case in point, Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina. When she was running, her campaign received emails asking if she was a Christian. And those emails went on to say things like, well, you know, because if she's a Christian, she can represent me. You know, if she's not, I'm not sure if she can. She actually converted and has become a Methodist, and I'm not making a judgment there. I don't know what is in her heart, but it's worth noting. Same thing with Bobby Jindal of Louisiana. He is converted to Catholicism. When Joe Lieberman was our Democratic candidate back in 2000, if I'm remembering correctly, you know, the fact that he was Jewish was an issue. The fact that Mitt Romney was a Mormon was an issue. This just shows you the extra hurdles that are out there for religious minorities, and particularly those who are religious and racial minorities. Their patriotism even gets questioned.
Is it ever possible to keep it in check in the sense of electing and supporting a candidate who has a religious background and to be sure that it will not have an interference, for want of a better term, in their work?
Well, you know, I would challenge the premise of that question. Those who are in power now.
That's my job. To challenge the premise of my own questions. Go ahead.
Those who are in power now, whether they're sitting on the Supreme Court, whether they are the mayor in your town, they are guided by their lived experience. We're not asking Christians to not have their religion, quote unquote, interfere. Why should we expect that? And I don't think that's the reality. I think what's reality is to understand that everyone's lived experience affects the decisions they make. And this is why we need people with diverse backgrounds in positions of power, so that we are hearing, we are having laws made, just public policy decisions made based on a variety of experiences. That's what we need.
When you look at this election, mm-hmm. and where we are right now, how much do you think this white Christian privilege will, what impact it will have as we move forward over the next 89 days before Election Day 2020?
It's had a consistent influence for hundreds of years, so I don't expect it to disappear or increase that much. I mean, I think that's what's important to understand, is that this book can seem timely now, but it's been timely for the last century. And that's what I want readers to understand. In the case I make, I kind of go through history to show what I mean about where whiteness and Christianity is embedded. And then I go on to talk about how this affects us today. And so I think it's a hard thing sometimes for folks to understand. You know, often people have a very negative reaction to this concept of privilege. What do you mean I have privilege? You know, what's important to understand, for example, if we're talking about white privilege, is that it is a product of systemic racism. For those who are white and who have that privilege, who have those advantages, many of them don't want it, but guess what? You have it, because that's how society's been constructed. That's not disappearing even by 2040 or 2050 when white folks become a numerical minority, as some data projections show. And so we're going to have to see the unevenness that's there in order to help bring more religions into the fold. And sometimes what happens is the religious right is very good at messaging, Joe, very good at messaging. And so they'll talk about minority groups and wanting special rights. The religious right really did this with the gay lesbian community starting right. in the 80s and early 90s. And so what happens is, and even now, when religious minorities set out to try to do the same thing that Christian groups are doing, whether it's around the holidays or something else, segments of the community be like, oh, they want special rights. No, they're not asking for special rights. They're asking to do some of the same things, like Sikhs wearing their turbans and serving in the military, that others get to do. But sometimes they're held out and not taken into account because they have a turban and they've always had to get special dispensation or to sue in order to serve in the military like anyone else.
You tell a story at one point of being reported to a colleague for quote-unquote hating white people. Talk a little bit about that. I'm just interested in how you navigate these issues and avoid, if that is possible, such insults.
Yeah, that happened with some students. And the thing is, when we're talking about issues of race, religion, GLBT issues, these are highly personal. Even if you're talking about law, case law, history. And so we have to remember the affective component, the emotional component of learning this information. And some people start feeling really bad about it. Some people experience guilt. You might be familiar with the phrase like white guilt.
Right.
And others kind of quote unquote act out, you know. And those are all understandable experiences. My goal, whether they be my students or whether they be my workshop participants, is to not let people get stuck there, is to make sure they move along. And sometimes there are consequences like this of my students complaining to colleagues. that, and that's not great, but sometimes those things happen, and where we have to keep that in mind is when it manifests in evaluations of professors, and people have to understand sometimes what's happening. As a woman of color, they are reacting not only to the material, but to me presenting it, which is why they could say, oh, Professor Joshi hates white people.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's really a reaction to the material and the person presenting it.
So it seems to me that what you want, and I by no means am putting words in your mouth, but just as in the form of a question, that you want people to walk away from this book thinking about at least the possibility of changing their focus. Would that be correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In the last chapter, I talk about ways to rethink things, and then in terms of taking action. So I talk about changing the language, changing the focus, and a few other things. And that's going to be important. We can't do the same old, thinking we're going to get a different, result. We're going to have to change how we've been doing things.
The name of the new book is White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. It is published by NYU. Kiathi Joshi, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you for having me, Joe.